Okay, so my name is Dr. Francina Turner, and I'm conducting an interview with Patricia Wheeler for the Reparative Histories and the Black Experience Oral History Project. So we'll begin with if you could tell me, at the time that you attended the University of Maryland, was your last name Wheeler?
Yes.
Okay. What's your hometown?
Washington, D.C.
When is your birthday? You don't have to provide the year.
December 29.
Okay, mine is December 20th.
Oh, happy birthday. Well, you're not a Capricorn, you're a
I
Sagittarius.
was this close.
This close.
How would you describe your life prior to enrolling at the University of Maryland?
Oh, that's a big open question. Like,
So,
it was.
I mean, in terms of sort of family composition, your home community, what was the your community's philosophy on higher education, things of that nature?
I grew up in DC. First, my mother and father, my father's a DC native. My mother moved up from Atlanta, Georgia when she was three, but they both went to D. My father went to I graduated from Armstrong, my mother from Dunbar, and she went to DC Teachers. And she was a teacher then a principal. So it was no doubt that we were going to go to college. I had this one sister. And she went to, well, she first went to Hampton, didn't like it, and transferred to Cornell. I really wanted to go to Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. They had just started accepting women, and I got accepted, but the tuition was very high. And I got accepted to University of Maryland. And at the time, even though I was out of state, tuition was pretty reasonable. I mean, compared to what it is now, so pretty was, I don't remember what it was, but it was under $1,000 a semester. But so I went to university. My first year I commuted, by the way, but my mother bought me a car. That was part of the deal. So I could commute to Maryland because since I didn't get to go to Lincoln, my sister got to go away to college. I didn't. But I had I don't, I went to McKinley High School, which was mostly black. So, although I went to Catholic school early on, and it was a mix with black and white folks, elementary school, although more probably more, but so, University of Maryland was a little bit of a sticker shock. Not so much. I think I was prepared for what I was going into, if not fully prepared. Nobody's ever fully prepared in an environment like that. And back then, it was definitely not what it is now. It was a lot of hostility. My first semester there, they still had what on Fraternity Row, they also had big Confederate flags hanging on their on front of their building. So that gives you a little bit of an atmosphere. But yeah, I was having a good time. I enjoyed McKinley. I loved my high school. I had some really great friends, some I keep in touch with. I had lots of good times in Washington, D.C.
What year did you enroll at the University of Maryland?
1968.
Okay. How did you come to decide what you were going to major in?
Whoa, that's a good question. I started out majoring in English because I thought I wanted to be a writer and a journalist at the same time. But and I didn't realize Maryland's journal. I don't know. I didn't have a good orientation. But anyway, I transferred to journalism my second year because I just the English thing I wasn't getting it. So I majored. I transferred to journalism. But I had been on the school newspaper back at McKinley. So I liked writing. I always did really well in English, and I loved to read. So I knew that it was going to be. Somehow, rather, I knew my career path was going to have be something to do with writing, and somehow, so journalism made a lot of sense for me.
Okay, you said I don't. I'm not sure if I heard you correctly. Did you say you didn't go to orientation, or you didn't have a good orientation?
I did not go to orientation, believe it or not. They scheduled my orientation for a day when we were traveling, so they said they would reschedule it, but they never did. I never got it rescheduled, so. I just, I think they did a do 2 day orientation, but I never got that 2 day orientation. And so, but even at that, I think that wouldn't have been enough. I think, for students who've not been exposed. I think years later, they started bringing students on for 2 weeks. I mean, some students, African-American students, and I think that made a lot of sense. But anyway, my first thing was to meet with an advisor who, by the way, the advisors aren't very good advisors, but that's another story. But I decided, I think my second year, I changed my major to journalism.
If you could, walk me through your memories of the first time you walked onto the campus as a new student.
Oh my goodness. Well, it was overwhelming. It was big. It was scary. I didn't know where I was going. I saw seas and seas of white people. But what was so nice is when you saw a black person, you say hi, because they were very friendly. But it was sort of intimidating. It really was. Until I found the student union. I don't know, back then, they had what they call the black corner of the student union, the commuters, and we gathered, and I met a lot of people. Several people from my high school were going to Merlin also as commuters. So it was great to hook up with them. I didn't feel the hostility. I have to tell you at first, I didn't feel the hostility that was underneath at first. It was just different. Nobody jumps out and says, calls you names or anything like that, at least not initially. So, but you just sort of feel lost, a little isolated. I don't know. I guess I hope that helps to explain it.
It does. Was there any point during your time at the University of Maryland where you lived on campus?
Oh, yeah. I had a really bad car accident. So my mother said, I'll pay for you to stay on campus for 1 year. And I ended up applying to be a RA. So then I ended up staying on campus because you get your room and board when you're a resident assistant. And I think you feel a lot more there. But also at the same time, you feel more of a sense of community. So when you feel more of the racism, you feel more of a sense of community. Because I made some really long lasting friendships living in the dorms, doing events on campus. I got involved. I think my first year when I was commuting, I didn't get very involved. I have to say, I went to a few BSU meetings and that kind of thing, but I really didn't get that involved. Although I was very, I did go to BSU meetings. My activism did start early, while a lot of commuters didn't think they should feel involved. I definitely right away. But I think when I moved on campus, it was much easier to get involved. But it was also I remember that I was taking an economics course, which I ended up dropping, thank goodness. Because 68 was that year of activism. I don't know if the Vietnam War, and they blocked Route 1 and they did a lot of things. And I was able to drop this course from hell, where the teacher called me and two other black students up one day after class and said to us, y'all don't seem to be getting this. Well, I wasn't, by the way, but why pick the three black students? I'm sure it was white people who weren't getting it too. And maybe he was trying to be helpful, but that's not how you help people. I think what I would have said is, any students who are really having a challenging time with this, come and see me. I really want to help you. I don't think he wanted to help us at all. I mean, the way his approach was and what he said to us and how he talked to us was not in the least helpful at all. It felt like we had been centered out and not, we all felt very, and he did it. And, it was like, he did it in front of the whole class. I mean, when he called us out. So when he called our names and had us come up there, and people were still leaving the classroom, and y'all don't be seen to getting this. So that's what I mean. It's like nothing was overt, like, okay, you don't get to, but it was, I know some students may have had issues, name calling, and that. I never had that. I just felt sometimes very isolated. You didn't have that many. There were hardly no Black professors at that time and no Black counselors. It was not a good environment. So that's why I think the BSU and other organizations, Narumbu started the next year I got there, or the first year. And I think that was very welcoming. The other thing, and this is interesting because they used to have a program called IED, Intensive Educational Development. I didn't come in that way. I came in as a regular student. I didn't even know what IED was. You know, I had good grades. I just came in as a regular student. I got accepted. So, but I think in a way it's a good program, but I think a lot of Black folks, they thought a lot of Black folks came in that way. You know, years later, I went to Columbia to get my graduate degree. I got an MBA and there was no special program. You just came in on your own merits. But even there, they thought, oh, you must have come in through affirmative action. I think those programs are good because I think they're really needed, but there needs to be another way of approaching it, so to speak. But anyway, it's hard to explain in some ways, but I think some of the programs that were in Narumbu, and then of course, starting the paper really helped me a lot.
I wonder if IED and the thing that I find most interesting about programs in that vein is often there's no support for when students get treated that way, right?
Yes.
So when you have to be in classroom and someone's telling you you're only here because of this, and what happens if you are here from that program? There's no support in place to help you deal with that kind of microaggressive behavior.
I agree. There's no support. And you're sort of sometimes singled out. And I think because some of the professors must know about the program, you know, like him calling me up to class afterwards saying, y'all don't seem to be getting this. No, I wasn't. But what I think what Columbia did, and they didn't have any special program, but what they did have is they had all kinds of tutors. If you needed a tutor, you could get it. Like I said, okay, I need a tutor for statistics. This stuff is killing me. But it wasn't just for any particular race, creed. Anybody could get a tutor if they were stuck. There are a lot of other ways you can approach programs like that. I don't know. I don't have the answer for that. But I think you're right. When people call you out of that, you don't have any way of support around that. You're absolutely correct. You don't know how to deal with that issue. And you're young. You don't know how to deal with those. Now I could deal with almost any issue people throw at me. But, you know, back then, you don't know what to say or how to act or what to do.
Now, you mentioned that
to close my window. I don't know if you hear this noise.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Running the lawnmower or something. It was such a nice day. I said, I'm opening my window. Now I gotta turn on my air conditioner. Okay, sorry about that.
No, you're fine. You mentioned that you were a member of the Black Student Union. And in a second, we'll get into the formation of the Black Explosion. But were you a member of any other organizations on campus during your time at the university?
I joined PACE for a year. I was doing some things with PACE, which I don't know if they still have. It was People Active and Community Efforts. A Black guy was heading at it when Joseph Fell, and he was trying to get more Black students involved. And I did a couple of things with them. We did visited the Veterans Hospital and some other things. I don't think I was involved in much beyond the BSU. I'm trying to think if I was. No. Oh. You mean outside of Black, or because there was a lot of Black stuff. They had a radio program called Yesternow, which that was a couple of years later. I mean, maybe in my junior year. So I worked with the radio station. I did some writing for Argus, which was the feature magazine. But no, nothing else.
So when it comes to the Black Explosion, you were a part of the Black Explosion from the beginning?
Well, okay, because me and a good friend have a big argument when he's pissed. The Black Explosion was it started as a literary magazine. You know, it had poetry and everything, and it was nice. But it was not a journalism thing. So it was floundering out there. I mean, I think it came out twice that first year. And so the next year, I said, okay, I'm going to take this thing over, and it's going to be a newspaper. And that's when it became a newspaper, as opposed to a nice little piece with people's poetry and stories and things like that. So it did exist before I got there, but it didn't exist as much because it wasn't out any kind of regular thing. When I took it over, we decided to do it. At first it came out once a month, and then it came out every other week. We got it up to every other week, but but the first it was, you know, so yes, I was the first editor in terms of it as a newspaper.
Okay. And so once you decided to take it from the sort of literary magazine to a newspaper, how did you build a staff? What was the original staff like?
Well, I didn't get any staff. I mean, I started it from scratch. I started recruiting people at the BSU meetings. I would say, I need some writers. You know, I need this. I went to a lot of the journalism majors. There weren't that many Black journalism majors, by the way. I was talking to Sandra Dawson Long, who was the second editor after me. And we're still good friends. She wasn't even there yet. She came 2 years after I was there. But, you know, I was approaching people. They didn't have to be in journalism. There weren't that many. And the few Blacks that were in journalism, even though they didn't work for the Diamondback was one of the most racist publications I've ever seen. And I don't think they've changed much, by the way. If you want me to talk about how racist they are, I will. But anyway, they're one of the most racist things I've ever saw and ever. Anyway.
I do, especially during your time as an undergrad.
Okay. But anyway, there were no Blacks there. And when you went to their office, they weren't welcoming. They weren't friendly. They didn't want you there. Now, but when I left, I guess the last year I was there, I ended up on the 5-year program. I didn't graduate in 4 years. You know, all kinds of things. You change majors, you drop courses, you just 5-year program. But anyway, Dwayne Wickham, who also is a very successful alumni, he just retired as Dean of Morgan. Did work for the Diamondback, and he actually ended up being their state editor or something. But he is one of the very, very few people I know who worked at the Diamondback and did okay. And maybe he was older, he had been in the Army, maybe that worked better for him. But I know the few approaches, and then some of the articles they wrote were just racist. I can't remember what the articles were, but I said, damn, do they not have any Black viewpoint on this article at all? And when they wrote about Black students, Black BSU, it was not, okay. I don't believe objectivity is, it's hard, but you can have a little bit more of a balance in terms of what you were trying to write. And I guess a lot of those students came from that white fraternity row with all those Confederate flags down there. So we used to be outraged at the articles a lot. And the Black students would talk about, oh, this is awful, this is racist. But you couldn't do anything about it. I think sometimes, maybe once in a while, there was a letter to the editor or something. And that's when we decided, look, we need our own newspaper. Because if you don't tell your own story, as John Russworm and the guy who started, I was trying to think of the first two people, the two journalists who started the first Black newspaper. Frederick Douglass came after them with his newspaper. But basically, if you don't tell your own story, no one else will. So we really, so that's why I decided. So how did I just kept asking people to write for me. And I got people who were stepped up and were willing to write for me. It was amazing that I got people to do it. And the BSU had some money in their budget for a newspaper. And so we went and got it printed. We had it printed by, we're trying to keep it Black, the Center for Black Education in DC, which was a Black institution. We had several Black folks who were photographers, you know, amateur photographers, but they did really good photography for me. Had somebody covering sports, the intramural stuff where the Black students were, Black teams were playing. So yeah, I just, you know, if I thought about it, I probably wouldn't have done it, but I just, you know, when you don't know what you're doing and you just jump out there and do it. And I think the first year I did it, it was, you know, real raggedy. I think second year I got a lot more organized, and a lot more people who are willing to step up and help me. Some short term, sometimes only an article. Other people stuck with it because they were journalism majors too, and they wanted to write where they thought their writing would be appreciated. And I think of some of the people who, you know, I look at some of the, I just saw the other day, a young lady who worked for us, her name is Singleton McAllister. She's a very successful lawyer, by the way, and she just got appointed to the board of the New Women's Museum that they're going to be building or getting together. And I was looking at all the people on that board. It had Billie Jean King, all these, and I think Singleton McAllister. I said, oh, she used to work for the Black Explosion. So my point is, you know, she came and said, I'd like to help with the Black Explosion. So even people who were, most of my staff were not journalism majors. So, but a lot of people, and we had a good time. We would, then we encountered the Merlin Media Board. That's another story. But afterwards, after we put the paper to bed, we had enough money to go have a pizza party and drink. We would, you know, it was just, it was a good way to camaraderie as well as putting it together. But when I met Sandra Dawson, then she was an English major too and switched to journalism. And she was really wanting to work with me. I don't know, we hit it off. She became the business manager and we started getting ads for the newspaper. It's really funny. I mean, we had the Bootleg, which was a shoe store down off Route 1 and some other places. There was Hungry Herman's and a bunch of places would take ads. So we were able to develop our own funds. Then they, Argus did something to get in trouble. They did a porno issue. The Board of Regents got upset. Everybody got upset. People were, so they did an independent board called Merlin Media, and they put all the publications on campus under the Merlin Media Board. Argus eventually went out of business. I actually wrote some record reviews. The editor of Argus was a guy named Mike Dolan, who I met. And he used to bring me albums because the record companies would send him albums. And so he would pull out the Black albums and give them to me to write record reviews. Mike and I are still friends, by the way. But it was so funny because he'd bring these record albums to the dorm and ask for my name. And everybody would say, he's here to see Pat Wheeler, because I was such, you know, activist, had a big push and everything. But anyway, he liked my record reviews. So, but anyway, I'm off track. But anyway, Merlin Media Board, they really didn't understand who we were or what we were. I was really upset that we had to come under this board because we should have been under the BSU, because I had been reporting to the president of the BSU. Now we had this Merlin Media Board. They didn't understand what we were. The only good thing about this was there was also a Jewish newspaper. I think it was just a Jewish newspaper. As a Jewish newspaper, there was us, there was Argus. I don't know, there must have been another publication. And so me and the Jewish editor were really feisty, and we just thought we should get our share of the money because the Diamondback at the time was making fists full of money. They were a daily newspaper. They had all this local, national, because, you know, you have a population of 30,000 plus students that you can reach every day. So they were making lots and lots of money, and we wanted our share of the money. So anyway, so we had to fight with the Maryland Media Board, Years later, I ended up sitting on the Maryland Media Board and fighting with them in the other directions on behalf of the student publications. Because I was working at Channel 11 back when I was invited to sit on the Maryland Media Board. And I thought that was a really full circle for me. Yeah, it was really awful with this Maryland Media Board because it was all white people on the Maryland Media Board. There was one good person on the Maryland Media Board, Dr. Barbara Hines. She's a journalism person who ended up hiring me to teach a course at Howard years later. It's funny how small the world is, right? But at the time, back then when I was fighting it, they had the people on the board, there was somebody from the Baltimore Sun. There were all these people. I didn't know where they came from, what they did. Nobody was Black on the Maryland Media Board. And they didn't understand why we needed this Black newspaper. And I had to educate them about the Black press and the history of the Black press. And that's why we have an African-American newspaper, blah, blah, blah. And they tried, it was awful. I don't even remember all the details. But anyway, we survived, the paper survived under the Maryland Media Board, despite that. And when I left the Maryland, Sandra Dawson became the editor, and she did a lot more with that paper than I ever did, but she really enlarged the staff and everything else. But as you said, it was just one person at a time, you know, asking people. And I think about it now, considering most of these, people were hungry for something like that. They couldn't work on the Diamondback. They couldn't get Black. And when we, you know, unlike today where students don't read a newspaper at all, people, when the paper came out, it was like, you know, grabbing it and wanting to read it and excited about it. And people wanted their stuff in the paper. And I was able to use people. We had artists who did drawing, like I said, photography. One of my photographers, Charlie Dorsey, I think that's his name. He was really good. He ended up going to work in LA. I don't know where he is now. I would like to find out where some of these people are. A person named Ron Brown was a great artist. He did some great drawing for us. I think he's still in Baltimore. One person at a time, just, you know, begging. I wasn't really begging. I was persuading. I don't think I ever begged. But Maryland Media made me, I had to take the newspaper away from the Center for Black Education. They said I had to bid it out. And then I made the case. So we ended up getting our paper done at this place in Maryland where the Hilltop did their paper. And I met the editor of the Hilltop, which is Howard's newspaper. But they turned out to be pretty good people who did our paper for us and printed it. There was nothing wrong with them. They just wanted this was not a Black company who ended up doing it, but they were also doing the Hilltop. It seemed like we were laying out our paper on the same nights up there. I guess, ask me some more questions because I don't know what else to say.
When you and your staff were able to take the Black Explosion from the literary magazine to the newspaper, what was the campus response in terms of Black students, in terms of white students? Like, what was the response to the newspaper?
Whew, I don't know if what white students' response was, because I didn't talk to that many white students, which is interesting because I did talk to white students, but not about the Black. I did not talk to white students about the Black Explosion. It just didn't happen. Black students, I think I told you, they loved it. They were excited to see it. If they had any activities going on, they wanted their activity in there. One thing that became, as it became more acceptable, the Black explosion, and somebody, I think somebody said, well, to me, not so anybody Black, isn't that sort of a violent name? And I said, no, it's not. Now, interesting enough, I would have probably never have named my newspaper Black Explosion. But since that was the name that it started, I didn't change it. I didn't want to make a whole big thing about changing it. But no, I didn't think it was a violent name. I think somebody might white said that. I said, no, it's not a violent name. But I felt it was like exploding upon the scene. This is exploding upon the scene. The Black students, like I said, they loved it. I think they loved having their stuff covered. I mean, and it was a record of things that were going on. Like Nirumbu started their awakenings. And we used to, cover them, full page spread of pictures and, account of what happened. So, there was no other record of Black things going on the campus. I mean, for years, that was, I understand after I left and after Sandra left and several people later, some young man decided that he didn't like the name Black Explosion and changed it. I was really perturbed. But then it was two newspapers. It was a mess for a while. But anyway, that was after I left. But I think, no, people loved it. They didn't have a problem with the name. They loved the coverage. They liked seeing, who doesn't like seeing their picture in the newspaper? I can't think of any criticism. We interviewed faculty people. We did, new faculty people came. We profiled them. How else, I don't think the Diamondback was covering, they were not covering the awakenings. They were not covering new Black faculty members. They weren't covering the different Black speakers we had on campus. And in some case, even when they did cover something, it was like a very narrow, for a very narrow perspective, not a global, not a national, or not even international perspective. And often somebody they may not have seen as important. I remember we actually had Alex Haley come to campus and we covered him. We covered him because he had written Malcolm X. He had not written Roots yet, although he talked a lot about it. People were really disappointed who came to hear him speak because they wanted to hear about the Malcolm X. And he was talking about all the research he'd done. He had not written Roots yet, but he'd been doing all this work on it. So that's what he talked mostly about. And we all, the BSU people, were saying, we brought him here to talk about the autobiography of Malcolm X. Why is he talking about his family history? We didn't know yet then how important, because Roots hadn't been written and it hadn't aired. We didn't know then how important that was. But all that to say, nevertheless, was Alex Haley. He had written a major bestseller. The Diamondback didn't cover that, So my point is, there was no other publication covering a record of who was coming. I lost all my diamonds. Sandra has some. I have maybe one or two issues. I hope they're somewhere on campus or somehow. But, I remember we even had Farrakhan. As controversial as Farrakhan is, he came to campus, but he had a lot of interesting things to say. And then afterwards, a few of us interviewed him as a head panel of journalists interview him and take pictures. And he was an interesting person. And he said, because we didn't just give him a gimme, we asked him some challenging questions. And I don't think he would have done that with the Diamondback sat there and gave us some really good insight. So we got to interview, and I think we went off beyond campus. J.C. Baldwin, is that his name? J.C., I'm gonna get his name. He was a graduate student, and he decided we needed to do this series interviewing members of the Black Caucus. So we interviewed Perrin Mitchell, and then we interviewed We went down to Congress and interviewed Perrin Mitchell, and then we did Walter Fauntroy. We didn't get any further than that. But think about it, a Black student newspaper going, nobody had done that, going to interview Congressman Perrin Mitchell, who was Baltimore, Maryland Congressman, and then Walter Fauntroy from DC. So we really did some, I think, some really groundbreaking things back then. And we were, I think we were very progressive, and more I think about it, we were pretty out there. But I, you know, as far as I can see, we didn't think we had any limitations. And like I said, if I thought about it, I probably wouldn't have jumped out and did some of the things we did. Like, hey, we're the Black Explosion. We'd like to come and interview you, Perrin Mitchell, because, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we got on his schedule and went down there and interviewed him. And we asked him a lot of questions about Maryland and the university and things that should be happening. But the interview went beyond that. So I actually found that interview and ended up framing and giving it to him, J.C. Baldwin, about 10, 15 years ago for his birthday, 50th or 60th birthday. I can't remember which one. But anyway, I found that article and framed it and gave it to him that we did with Eva Perrin Mitchell and Walter Fauntroy. So he was one of our few graduate students that were involved. Yes. But so, yeah, I look back now, I think we did some groundbreaking things. So,
and that's right in line with what I was about to ask you about. So you were an active student at Maryland during some really key pivotal times in general, but the transition from for the Black Student Union from being core to Black Student Union, the creation and sort of legitimization of the Black Explosion. At the time, did you realize what you all had, that there would be this legacy? What were you feeling or thinking in the time?
You know, that's funny. No, I didn't think that there would be a legacy. In fact, I was hoping that the Black Explosion would last 2 or 3 years. No, I didn't think that at the time. I was pleased that it was able to continue even in any form. I mean, rather, I think Sondra pushed it to become a weekly for a while. I think it was there. And then over the years, I think it went back to being bi-weekly, a month. I don't know what happens now. Over the years, it was always, unfortunately, the paper has always been the vision of whoever the editor is. And that's unfortunate. That I wish, because the editor should not just be allowed to change. The editor should not have been allowed to change the name, change the format, change this. There should have been, Merlin Media was not helpful in that regard at all. If they were going to do anything, they wouldn't have let somebody, editor, come in and just change the Diamondback. So even though I don't think a bunch of people who, you know, over the years, you know, I wish there had been some guidelines, and that I didn't, you know, I was too young to know about that. But as I was leaving, I knew I was turning it over to Sandra, who would put it in good hands. And then she turned it over to somebody else who knew it in good hands. But, you know, as you go down and down, you know, it shouldn't have been at the whim of an editor. And I think if it had been under the BSU, that would not have happened. I think it would have been still under the auspices. It should have been a student publication of the Blacks. And we used to put that on the headline, student publication of the Black Student Union. Once that didn't happen, once it had to go into Merlin Media, it changed a lot. And also it changed and now became the whim of whatever editor it was. So that was unfortunate, I think. But I didn't think that far ahead. I knew the paper was in good hands with Sandra. But I didn't think that it would have continued as long as it did and continued as successfully as it did. And also, too, that students would be proud of working. A lot of students would be proud of working on the Black Explosion. I know when I interviewed at the Washington Daily News for internship, you know, by that time, I was writing a lot of op-eds, which were very obviously slanted. And the editor asked me, he said, can you write straight news? I said, I can write anything. I think being an editor gave me confidence, if nothing else, working on a paper. I don't know. And I'll give you a good example. Young lady, she's been out, I won't say her name, but she's been out of Maryland now for four years. And she's very successful. But she was working on the Diamondback. This would have been 10 years ago, maybe about 10 years ago. That would have been, 2012, 2013. So you would have thought, okay, Diamondbacks come a long, long way. They're literally liberal now. She loved sports and she was covering sports. I think she was covering the volleyball or rugby or some team that wasn't a major team. And they went and looked at her Facebook page or Twitter page and said she was, this is her personal page, it wasn't the Diamondback page, that she shouldn't be wearing a bathing suit on her page because it wasn't professional. And then the big thing though was, is they accused her of plagiarism. Now, the reason I knew this young lady is her mother had called me up. It turned out her mother, she wanted to go to NABJ when she was a freshman. And her mother looked at the list of people attending and saw my name. And her I had been friends 20 years ago. And she says, I don't want my daughter. She's a freshman. She wants to go to this conference. It was far away, Las Vegas, LA. I don't want to go. Will you look after her? I said, of course, but I need to meet her. So I met her. She was fine. Me and Sandra ushered her around National Association of Black Journalists Conference. But anyway, that next year, they accused her of plagiarism. And then when you accuse somebody of cheating or covering an article, then you compare the two articles side by side and say, okay. They said they didn't have the articles from which she plagiarized. So how can you, they just remembered. Well, how can you accuse somebody of plagiarism and the articles exist nowhere? They said because of some computer failure, they didn't no longer have the articles that she plagiarized. So they fired her. Her mother called me. I was upset. Sandra was upset. I got Dwayne Wickham involved. He was a dean in Morgan. And the only thing could happen because it's an independent newspaper in the Maryland media and the guy who's now, who was in charge of Maryland media back then, the horse's ass, Mike Frisbee, he'd been there when I was there. So he'd been there forever. He was riding off that really lucrative thing for a long time. He wouldn't let me speak to the editors of the, he said it wasn't, I couldn't speak to them. He wouldn't give me any information. The editor, the dean of the school said she couldn't do anything because it was independent. But if she could take there's a student law association, she could take it before that and help her. And you know what, the young lady said, you know what, that's fine. I don't need them, I'm quitting. She had gotten an internship at the Baltimore Sun. And she ended up getting internships at USA Today, on and on and on, and she's doing fine. But my point is, early in your college career, somebody accuses you of plagiarism with no evidence of plagiarism. They also look at your Facebook and Twitter, like they're looking for stuff. And there were two editors, they had co-editors at the time. That would have never happened. And I didn't get on her for saying, why aren't you working at the Black Explosion? Because we really didn't have a really good sports section. If you really wanted to cover sports, and there was no way we were covering all those things that she was covering. I mean, she's really into sports. So, but nothing would have ever happened at the Black Explosion to a Black person like that. And I doubt that she did plagiarize. I really don't. Knowing her, there's no way she plagiarized. But if somebody had a plagiarize, I don't know if it would have been handled that way. At least I hope not. I don't think I would have said something. It would have been hard to plagiarize it, first of all, for the Black Explosion, because we were covering mostly these rinky-dinky Black Expense that nobody else was covering. So how could you plagiarize it from another article, right? So nobody else was writing about whatever was happening in the room booth. So who would you plagiarize it from? But I think if I thought something, I would have handled it differently. Even back then, but I don't think that would have been an issue. But my point is, that was sheering out racism. I mean, I was infuriated that in the 20,000s, that was still going on and that a Black person would be treated that way. and not even talk. I mean, the way she was talked to, the way it was handled, her mother was so upset. I mean, the whole thing was just outrageous. But as she said, as Allison said, the best revenge is living well. And she's gone on to do so well in the whole sports arena. But I just think if the Diamondback was treating people that way and then had no accountability, none. When I said, well, how can you accuse people of plagiarism and they'll have an article? And he would not. Well, that's just too bad. That's what they think. Anyway. I'm still infuriated. It's been 10 years and I'm still infuriated every time I think about it. I'm sure some Black people now work at the Diamondback, but it's still probably too few. And it's purely still not the warm and welcoming atmosphere it can be. Yes, journalism is a cutthroat world. It can be cutthroat. It can be very competitive, but I've worked there. And there are also people in journalism who know how to mentor talent. They spot talent. I was mentored in journalism. You know, so you see somebody good, you want to help them along. You don't want to attack them and look at their social media. But what you say is, maybe this isn't what you want to put on social media, because even though it's not our social media page, people may be checking you out. They may see your byline and go, I mean, there's just ways you handle things. But anyway, if there's no accountability and Maryland Media Board is pretty awful. Mike Freebush wouldn't even give me the names of the people on the Maryland Media Board. I said, how can a nonprofit board that gets this money, gets this money from the Diamondback revenues, but still it's a nonprofit board with something, and you can't even tell me the names of the, back when I was on the board, it was public information because people could contact us with their concerns. What the hell? I was going to follow that up because I couldn't believe you could have a board, the 501c3, where you could not have the names of the board members. That was just outrageous. Anyway, don't get me started on the Maryland, on the Diamondback. They're racist then and they're racist now. And I will say that. I guess they could sue me, but hey, I would still say it because I am, Now, I know things are tight for newspapers, and I don't think they print daily anymore. I think they're all online, but they're probably still races online.
Do you remember any sort of specific campus protests while you were at Maryland? Are there any protests that stick out to you?
Oh, yeah, a bunch. We had one on something happened. Some of our members got arrested for doing something, and one of the guys from BSU got his arm broke, Chris Young, and we did a demonstration outside of the Hyattsville police station. Knowing now how racist we were taking our lives in our hands, but we did a demonstration around the police station and protested because I think it was four Black folks and they didn't move somewhere fast enough or they were somewhere and they started knocking them in the head and Chris actually got his arm broke. I had my experience with that police station during that. Sandra and I were on our way into DC. I still had my car and I got pulled over by one of those Hyattsville, Prince George's County Police. They've changed. No, they haven't changed that much. And I said, why did you pull me over? I wasn't speeding. I said, you must pull me over. You saw I was a Black woman. I should have never said that. He got so mad. He said, oh, you think I'm picking on you? So he pulled me. He told me to get in. He made me get in the police car. He told Sandra to follow us to the police station. He put me in the police tank with all the hookers and stuff they had arrested. And he said to Sandra, can you drive? And she said, I think so. He said, well, get out, $50 fine. So, which is a lot of money back then. So she ran back, she drove back and she went around the dorm to try to get $50. And she got Eddie come back with her. But when he took me before the magistrate, there was no charge. He said, this colored girl here thinks I'm picking on her. So we need to fine her. So they fined me $50. But there was no demonstration as a result of that. But I'm just saying that was the Prince George's County Police back in the late 60s, early 70s. But we had that demonstration around the police station. We had several on the mall protesting just different issues, everything from not having Black studies to the racism on campus to wanting more Black professors. So we had a lot of demonstrations and rallies that we covered over the years. But I remember the big one was at the police station because we were all sort of scared because we didn't want those cops coming out there swinging their billy clubs at us. The ones on the campus, I don't think we were as scared. It's really funny. We had so little power on campus, but yet I remember when we had these demonstrations and rallies, they weren't secret because I think we all said there were spies and stuff, but there would be so many police officers around, you know, it was like we were going to burn the place down. We never took over a building like some places did. We wanted to take over a building, and we actually were going to take over a building, but that didn't work out. It was some miscommunication for a lot of the BSU people who were planning it, and it didn't happen. Well, it fizzled, but we did have a lot of demonstrations and rallies and protests, demands to meet with the president, and things that we wanted to see. We did meet with the, when we say we, I don't mean me, because I was never an officer in the BSU. I was, I take that back. For the first year, I got selected as a commuter representative to the BSU. I forgot about that. I was commuter representative. And then when I moved on campus and started a newspaper, I was on the BSU board, but only as representing as the editor of the newspaper when I started the newspaper. It wasn't immediately that I was a representative. But yeah, when I was commuting, I was on the BSU board as commuter rep because they had, dorm representatives. And then for the commuters, they had two people as the commuter representative. But yeah, we had a lot of rallies and demonstrations over the years. I mean, I was there 5 years. And made demand. And over the years, we saw improvements. I mean, they did hire more professors. They did have Black studies. I remember during my time there, Dr. Frances Mary Berry came. I think the students who are there now have a lot to thank the activism of the students who were there then. I don't know, Terrence Cooper was an officer, Dan Kitt. I wish I could remember all the names. Terrence Cooper was really a good BSU president. They had, thanks to the work of some really strong people back then, that I think the students are able to, we really pushed hard for more, increased the enrollment of Black students. We actually did recruiting ourselves. We started recruiting. We forged a relationship with University of Maryland Eastern Shore. In fact, I went with one of the officers from the University of Maryland down to Eastern Shore to meet with the Black students down there and discuss a relationship. So I think a lot of the changes that have happened, I think they have a big thanks to the students who were there in the 60s and the 70s who really pushed for a lot of things.
I wanted to tell you, it's sort of an aside, but I think it also matters. I mean, we could have the longest conversation about the importance of the Black press, right?
Right.
But one thing I found doing research in a whole different area, it was on early Black PhDs and how they were faring working in white colleges. So this was published some time ago. But one of the editors of this book that was a survey of Black professors at white institutions said that he has such a hard time getting institutions to report out on the numbers of Black faculty that he'd have to resort to using the student newspapers where all would list, these are our Black faculty members, right? Okay. And I saw that several times in the Black Explosion in the early days where there was these lists of Black professors, staff members and professors. And so I just thought that was something I should tell you, that work went past just letting the Black students on campus know they had resources, but also in larger scholarship when the universities wouldn't report out on the numbers.
That's wonderful to know. That's great to know. Thank you for telling me that. Yep.
And I could send you, because I believe I have the book as a PDF. So I should be able to send it to you. But I thought that was amazing.
That's amazing.
And I've seen it across quite a few Black student papers at white colleges that, and that's what the Black press does. Like, the life of that community is in the pages of those papers.
Right. So that's so wonderful to know. Thank you for telling me that. Mm-hmm. I taught on a white campus for a year. I was a sabbatical replacement. I taught at American University. It was the worst year I've ever had. I mean, it was, I taught there. It was in probably in the 80s. No, it was in the 90s. I, you know, those white students treated me like I was less than dirt. And people said, well, did you tell them you used to work at the White House? You have an MBA? But I said, well, why should I have to tell them all that? But anyway, they treated me like, you know, and there were no, I had like one Black student in most of my classes. And it was one of the worst years that I've ever had. And, you know, I taught at Howard as an adjunct, just one class because I was working full time. And for the first time, when I stopped being a practitioner, I taught at Howard full time. Dwayne Wickham hired me. It makes a difference in that environment. It really does make a difference. The students don't look at you like you're less than dirt, or why are you here and not cleaning up my house as the maid? So, you know, there are other challenges teaching at a Black school, trust me, HBCUs, but it's not because of racism where you don't feel like you belong or you're not appreciated at all. So anyway, I know I've rambled on and on. Have I answered most of your questions?
You have, absolutely. And I have maybe two or three more questions, okay, and then we're done. If possible, can you walk me through your memories of the last time you walked off campus as an undergraduate student, where you're going towards graduation?
Woo. In my last year, I actually don't think Sondra, you know, my last year there, I was not editor of the Black Explosion. I turned it over to Sondra. And I was, because I was working, I think I told you there was a campus radio station, and we took over there. We said, you need to give us some time. So we started on Yesternow. So I did news for the campus, the Black show, Yesternow. So I was doing that. And I think I wasn't doing much of that either, because I was working, my summer job, I was at the Washington Daily News, and they got bought out by the Star. And I went to the Star as a dictationist, which I kept doing part-time. I also was interning at Channel 4, WRC, NBC, in DC, because I went to the dean and I said, hey, newspapers keep getting sold out from under me. I'd like to go into broadcasting. And he arranged for me to get this non-credit, non-paid internship at Channel 4 in DC. But that was good, because I learned an awful lot. So I was working internship, two part, one getting paid, one not getting paid. So I really wasn't doing much with the Black Explosion. I kept in touch and stuff like that. Plus, I had all these credits because I was trying to get the hell out of there. So my last semester, I was working like crazy. I was doing those two jobs. I finally quit the Washington Star, but for a while I was doing both at the same time, because I would do this like overnight shift. So, you know, I would go to school during the day and do these overnight shifts. And finally, my last semester I was carrying 21 credit hours and working two part-time jobs, but I did better than I ever did, because I was getting out of there. I was taking mostly journalism courses and I loved it. And, I always tell my students, find something you have a passion for, because you'll work hard at it and you'll enjoy it. And if you're just doing it to be doing it, you're not going to ever work hard at it. And you're not going to find the money, because people, students nowadays, want the money, but you don't have a passion for anything. But anyway, so I guess my last time on campus was when I graduated. I went to, graduation. We, you know, in Maryland was so big. It was in Coldfield House. And, you know, you stand up when they call. And the speaker that year was like Howard K. Smith, who was a journalist, did now. And so we were really happy. I had started out in journalism. And when I started out, it had been part of the School of Business and Public Administration. They created its own college. And so we were like, I was in like the first graduating class of this College of Journalism. So that was a really big deal. And I didn't have a job. That was not a big deal. Coming out, and I was interviewing like crazy. I was having everybody help me type letters. You know, we didn't have computers back then. So I was typing letters, sending them out, interviewing. I did finally get a job in Richmond, Virginia, working for a radio station. But in the meantime, I was working and getting paid at Channel 4 as a desk assistant, a substitute. And I was working like a desk assistant for local as well as network. And it was exciting because Watergate was going on then. And so I was working a lot on the network side and on the local side. So I was busy. So I had this part-time job, but I wanted a full-time job of my own. And I went to Richmond to work at this radio. It was so racist down there. I was so glad to get the hell out of Richmond, but that's a story for another day. So my last time on campus, I'm sure, was when I graduated. But I was my last semester, I was going to classes, going to Channel 4, working overnight, working early in the morning. And then, you know, graduation day came and I was on cloud nine. And I don't think I went back for a really long time. I don't think I went back to campus I don't recall. I didn't go back for like homecoming or anything like that. I did get invited back to speak several times at classes. And I did go back to speak. In fact, one class time I went back to speak. When I ended up going to Portland, Oregon, working in TV for 2 years. And then I came back to Channel 11 in Baltimore. And when I was invited back to speak, I ended up hiring an intern from one of the classes. And I ended up, she's been one of my mentees. Now she's in her 50s. So I can't call her a mentee anymore. But I went back to speak. And then I was on the Merlin Media Board. So I went back for those meetings. But once I left, I don't think I went back till I was asked to speak at several classes because I was at Channel 11 and people knew about me. And I was invited to be on the Maryland Media Board. But I think once I got the hell out of there, I don't have a love for University of Maryland like I have for my high school. I'm proud of it now. In fact, I just joined the Alumni Association. We have a Black president. I want to see him do well. I mean, there was a Black president before. So I feel, you know, over time and distance, you feel a lot more warm about it and cuddly. So I've been trying to feel more warm about my days at Maryland. I'm still proud of what we did with the Black explosion. I did not realize I was creating something that would have any kind of legacy and that would be around for as long as it has been. And that so many people who may or may not have, you know, spent the fact that you, when you work in an organization, any kind of organization, it helps develop you, it helps build your experience. So so many people came through that Black explosion that worked on it that have got that as part of their background. It'll never go away.
So in closing, and I think you've kind of responded to this a little bit already, but I want to formally ask, is there anything that you would like to share considering your time at Maryland as a message to current and future students, particularly Black students?
I hope that, you know, I know things are a lot looser and liberal, appear to be liberal, but they're still undercurrent of racism that exists out there, systematic, even though some people want to deny that it exists. And I hope they remember to appreciate the relationships. They don't have to be active, even though I wish they would, but with the whichever way they can with other African-American people of African-American descent, in whatever way they can, be it the newspaper, be it outreach organizations, internal organizations. I really hope they build those lasting relationships because, like I said, many of them have lasted me the rest of my life. And I'm so hopeful that they will build those relationships. Don't take that for granted because, like I said, even when you, I've been out here a long time. And like I said, I've worked in white organizations, Black organizations. And even though you think, oh, this is different, I'm different. No, you're not. Don't forget where you came from, who you are, and that your community is willing to back you up when you need it. So, you know, give back to them in ways that you may never, even when you leave school, continue to give back. Find something that you like, and hopefully with the community, and continue to give back to that organization. I tried a number of Black organizations I continue to support, give money to, and I really appreciate all the things they do, starting with the NAACP. So those people walking around that campus would not, they may think they're smart and they got there on their own, but there are a lot of smart Black people out here. So I hope they realize and appreciate the people who did the work before them. Like I said, I looked at some of the smart people that I worked with and how they really, I mean, they had a plan. They worked it to see that through demonstrations, rallies, meeting, protests, that we got more African-American students, more African-American teachers. And, you know, that didn't happen by accident. That did not happen by accident.
Ms. Wheeler, I want to thank you so much for taking time to do this interview with me today. If I have any follow-up questions, is it okay to reach out?
Yes, please. Anytime. You have my phone numbers. Let me ask you a quick question. Mm-hmm. You're at Maryland?
Well, virtually. I'm in North Carolina, but I'm a postdoctoral associate at Maryland.
So what does postdoctoral associate mean? So that's what I wanted to ask you.
I'm a postdoc in Black Digital Humanities, essentially. And so I'm split in between the University Archives and ADHUM, which is African American Digital Humanities. It's a center on campus. And what I was hired to do was to sort of further develop and then conduct interviews and analyze interviews for this project.
Sounds interesting. What are you going to do with all this information?
Well, we're going to do several things. We're going to do some writing around it. There's a next step after we do the interviews where we really look at what would meaningful change look like on this campus. Now that we have the stories of your graduates, right? So there hasn't been any large scale oral history project for Black students at Maryland. But now that you have it, it's one thing to be able to say, well, this is what we know of our students when you didn't keep a record, right?
Right.
It's another thing to know how students experience the campus and then for current administration to, what then do you do to ensure that maybe you don't have students who feel this way again? Or how do you strengthen things that these students felt were strong, right? Mm-hmm. How do you allocate resources in the right area? So that's a part of it as well. And then we're putting together digital projects. So we're looking at doing a place-based exhibit, you know, places on campus that students felt comfortable, places on campus that maybe don't have a positive background in conjunction with clips from the interviews of alum talking about their experiences in those locations. So, and then also the interviews are going to be deposited in the university archive. So there's this, and it's definitely not just at Maryland, a generational disconnect where you might have students now who don't understand that their enrollment at the University of Maryland didn't happen by chance and just because they're really good students. Right, they might not know the history of what students had to do, Black students pushing the door open and keeping it open. That might be a history they don't know. And so that's another reason we wanted to conduct and collect these interviews. So that's kind of big picture what we're looking at in terms of the project.
Okay, well, you got sounds like an overwhelming project. And how are you picking your people?
So I did an extensive amount of archival research. So I looked through all the Black Explosion issues, all of, I looked through some Argus, some Diamondback, and then the Eclipse, local newspapers, and it was a little heartbreaking because the first Black graduate was in 59. That's like yesterday.
Right.
You know, and so I essentially started with these two undergrad students who enrolled in the 50s and went forward. Oh, okay. And so that's where I got the idea of kind of who I wanted to talk to. But then also any Black graduate of UMD, we'd want to interview as many as possible. Because the numbers, even when the numbers were sort of critical mass enough that it felt like there wasn't a small number, in the grand scheme of things, there has always been a small number.
Right.
So.
Well, you made me remember some things as we were talking, and I'm sure there's a lot of things I don't remember because it's been a really long time, but it's been interesting trying to, you know, remember all of that stuff. From years and years ago. So thank you. If you want to pick up with this Black explosion, you could talk to Sandra Dawson Long Weaver now. I don't know, Terrence Cooper, have you come across that name?
No, I haven't.
He was the BSU, I don't know, he was the BSU president and I was there. He was just, I thought he was excellent. And then I was trying to think of some other people, but I can't remember those names right now. So, but anyway, I'm glad you were able to go back and look at the, you know, Black Explosion to come up with some names.
Okay, definitely.
Yeah, so if you have any other questions, have you talked to Mel Hollis? Have you come across that name? He was on the faculty.
I think I've come across the name, but I don't think I've been able to make contact.
Yeah, I don't know where he is either. I mean, he's been around. He was at the White House under Obama. He was at the, because he spoke in Morgan when I was there. So he was at the White House initiative on Black colleges and universities. But I don't know where he is now, but he would be a really good person to speak to. If you can. If I find where he is, I'll send you the information.
Okay, thank you so much. And if there's anybody else you can think of that you think might be open to an interview, I am more than willing and happy to interview him.
Okay, great. I might come up with some names and numbers and send them to you.
Okay, thank you so much. And thank you for taking time on your weekend to talk to me.
Oh, no problem. Take care. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.